Today is May 23rd, 2009. This is Conduit. The panel is The Mike Show.
For anyways, because they hit puberty like...
I'm serious. I'm sorry.
Ask a question. I rephrase it.
He's entertained.
So but before we do that, let's introduce yourself. Let's go down and introduce yourself. Tell us what your latest work is and what you're doing, okay?
Well, I'm Dave Wolverton / Dave McFarlane. My latest work that's out is Wormling Horde, book 7 of the Runelord series. Book 8 of the Runelord series comes out in October. It's called Berserker Lord. I've also got a book called In the Company of Angels coming out. It's about the Willie Hancock Company. And I've also got, that's coming out in September, and then also in September I've got Freaky Fly Day, which is book 3 in the A Mice and Magic series.
So you went with they went with the new artist for book 8?
They did, yeah. Daryl Sweet's getting rather old.
So are you happy or sad that you've got a new artist?
I'm happy. I've got a cool, smooth cover, and I really like it.
Yeah. I know that a cover can kill a book.
But Daryl Sweet's good, and he's got good resonance and everything. But I think that feels a little old-fashioned stuff that way. So I like this new book.
Okay, James.
Hello, I'm James Dashner. I have a middle grade series called The 13th Reality. Book 2 just came out. Then I have a trilogy starting with Random House this fall called The Maze Runner.
Now, will it be published this fall? Will it be published or out this
fall? It comes out October 6th.
So it's in the hopper.
We already have advanced copies.
Okay, great.
Larry Correa, my first novel is Monster Hunter International, comes out from Bain Books July 28th.
What age group is it?
Adult.
Adult?
Adult, yes.
Okay.
Don't give it to your little kids.
Okay.
I'm John Brown, and I've got a 3-book deal with Tor for an epic fantasy series. The first one comes out October 13th, and it's about a place where humans are being ranched, and it's called Servant of a Dark God.
Good name. Okay, we'll have some questions for our panel. Okay.
A lot of softball. What are the biggest mistakes that you see beginning writers make?
They see writers making
beginning
now?
Beginning writers, yeah.
Just beginning writers? That they made them? Okay, let's go up there. Let's see. What's the mistakes that you see writers making now, beginning writers, and what were the mistakes that you made that you overcame?
Beginning writers, first thing that I see them doing is writing for critics and not for real audiences. There's a vast difference. I mean, if you're writing for a critic who's 52 years old and your audience is teenage boys or something, you're way off mark. So that's the first mistake I see. The biggest thing that I think that I had to overcome was I think you need to put your books out faster now than you did when I was starting out. I think you need a minimum of 1 book a year, preferably 2 books a year.
I think beginning writers don't realize that no matter how good they are or how good they aren't, there's so much room for improvement. And just, I look at my own little career that's, I got serious maybe 10 years ago, and I look at what I wrote then compared to what I wrote now. I'm 100% completely a different writer because I've worked hard. I've gone to writers' conferences, I've read books, I've practiced by writing a lot, and I still absolutely don't think I've reached even close to what I want to become. You have to accept that. You have to have a goal to always get better. So every book I write better be...
You're hoping it's better,
better than
last.
The one before. And I think with my own personal career, mistakes I made in my beginning writing and beginning books, I don't think I did enough character development, and I think I rushed my story too much. I was so excited for this cool thing to happen, and this cool thing to happen, and this cool thing to happen, but I didn't have enough depth to my stories. That's something I really worked hard on.
I guess I am a beginning writer.
If you've got a novel, so not quite.
Yeah, and actually I self-published it originally, and it did really well. So I've got a few cans. But biggest problems I've seen for beginning authors is wooden or unbelievable stock characters. If you ever picked up a novel from somebody, it's former Navy SEAL so-and-so. It's probably not going to be very good.
If that's the advertisement for it, you know it's going to be this Navy SEAL doing everything, and no other character has any life at all.
Yeah, it's just so biggest. I mean, you know, like you guys, but once you had some success, all your friends that are wannabe writers give you their books to read too. And the biggest problem I've seen are just unbelievable or uninteresting characters. Biggest mistakes I've seen.
Can I add something to that?
Go ahead.
Another thing that I see in my own career is giving depth to villains. A lot of times the bad guy is just, you know, pure evil and all he wants to destroy the world. And it's just, there's no layers to the bad guy or no depth.
No reason why he's evil. No, the evil overlord, but no background.
That's why I love the story of Voldemort and Harry Potter. When you start learning about his childhood, and, you know, you see him getting picked on, and you start having empathy for this guy who's totally evil. And I feel like in my 13th reality books, my villain, I didn't do enough of that in the first book, so I tried to make up for it and give her some depth. Her, I love evil women. And I really try to give her some depth in the second book.
Okay.
Kind of along what you said.
I'll say beginning meaning people that haven't broken in yet.
Right.
The things that I see are not making enough time, and so what happens is they'll go and then they fall off and they're not able to finish projects or keep at them long enough to make them work. And then the other thing that I think is a huge issue is writing for rules instead of effect, which to me means I'm going to write this thing and I'll submit it to my writing group or whoever. And we're going to look at all these writerly rules that we've amassed over reading all these books and listening to all these people. And I'm going to try to make my book fit these writerly rules instead of the effect of it's interesting, it's enthralling, it's whatever it's supposed to be. And they get caught up in all these little rules that, frankly, they're just techniques. And so you can't really break a technique. You can just apply it or misapply it. And whether it's appropriate or not, it just depends. So that's what I see.
What about yourself?
What
was your biggest, some of your biggest?
The first one was my biggest stumbling block. It was not making time. So it took me probably 10 years to, that was one of the things that was holding me back. And once I figured that out, it was just like clockwork. I was able to produce.
You set aside so much time per every day
to do. Yeah, so I got a full-time job and I got kids and I do not want to sacrifice my family. I don't want to succeed in writing and then find that I've got nothing but my books to keep me warm when I'm old and ugly, right? Or uglier.
But you set it up kind of a second job.
So I did, and I had to say...
I
have to get up at 5 o'clock in the morning and write for an hour and a half at 5 o'clock in the morning and an hour at lunch. And if I don't do that, nothing would have ever happened. I just had to make those sacrifices. So, yeah.
Okay, yeah.
Just to jump off right what he said, my next question was going to be, what, and you probably already answered it for you, but what habits do you consider to be successful habits as a professional working writer?
Okay, let's change that a little bit. Let's kind of go with the same thing. What habits, as a successful writer, did you have, but also what habits did you have to break so you could become a successful writer? What habits did you really have to push through and break? Let's start down there.
One big habit was getting up and writing and just pushing through. But there was another mental habit for me that was absolutely killing me, and that was when I would come to, when I get quote unquote writer's block, you know, or I come to a part where I ran out of ideas or whatever. My mental process was to say, I suck. I can't do this. Oh, it's never going to work. I was never supposed to write. And I would go through that type of a mental process, and when I finally said, "Wait a minute, that isn't it," you know, this is just a normal thing. and I would write through that, and I started listening to my writer's block, actually listening to it and saying, what is it that it's telling me? When I started doing that, that practice and the writing, taking my writing time, those are the two things that, that changed everything for me. Okay. So those are two incredibly important practices for me. Okay.
You see what John said about the listening to your writer's block and saying, you suck, all four of us nodded. That's pretty universal in there. It's one thing is just to bowl through, to be positive about yourself and say, yeah, I can do it. This is going to sound really silly, but one of the things that helped me make it as a writer is I read some really terrible bestsellers. Uh-huh. And I remember reading these novels and thinking,
I can do better than that.
Yeah, oh my gosh, if this dude can get published, I can. And that time is a killer. Setting aside the time to actually sit down and have a schedule and produce is
and then keeping to the schedule.
Yeah, it's
turning that into a habit.
I don't know about you guys, I still struggle with that myself. You know, because it's a lot easier to just sit down and play a video game than it is to get to work. So.
Yeah, but, I mean, it's...
That habit, same thing. Is it just the same habit?
It's completely irrational how self-deprecating that can be. I mean, I went on the... For the Maze Runner, they sent me on this, what they call it, pre-publicity tour, where I go to these cities, and the whole point of this seems to me was to give you a big head. Because you go to these cities, they tell you they love your book, you meet with librarians, booksellers, and just the most wonderful week I've ever had in my entire life. I came home, and I read one review on Goodreads. Some lady hated the book, and I said, my book sucks. No one's going to read this thing. It's going to bomb. Seriously, for several hours, I was so depressed about this one review on Goodreads. It was completely irrational. It's almost like worried I'm insane or something. But so I really struggle with that. I always have just being pessimistic about my writing and about my future and all this. And that hasn't ended, even though I've started to get a little bit of success. But in terms of writing habits, I'm kind of nerdy. I mean, I was an accountant before I was...
And then you rebel because you're like, no, there's no first.
Seriously, I didn't want to spend the rest of my life sitting behind a desk, so I decided to be a writer.
It definitely gave me motivation to see my career go somewhere. But anyway, so I kind of have this, well, some people would say it's kind of, I have this nerdy side. So I actually always keep a spreadsheet where I track my daily writing. And so what I do, it really helps me. I know it's nerdy, but it helps me so much. I figure out, okay, I have to write this book in this amount of time. Because, you know, it's lucky when you start getting deadlines and stuff. It's a wonderful problem to have. I figure out how much time I have, how much time I want the first draft to be completed within. And actually set up kind of a goal, a path. I'm going to do 2,000 words a day or something like that. And then I track myself every day. I mean, it's really rewarding at the end of the day to say, okay, I did my 2,000 words. I'm on pace. And that helps me a lot.
So, two things. I started out writing when I was like 17 years old. And my first couple of books, I would get about, you know, 4 to 10 chapters into it. And then I couldn't figure out what was supposed to happen next. Okay, and so my habit, I think there's a couple things. First of all, I'm a nice guy, so I'm always trying to help people do things, always trying to fix things, you know, that kind of stuff. And as an author, I need to learn how to break things and how to mess people up and stuff like that. So my big habit that I had to break was to quit being a nice guy and quit trying to give the reader all of the information that they need to understand the situation and that kind of thing, and just be willing to go in there and try to make things worse for my people all the time. That was one of my big things that I needed to learn how to do.
Throw the bucket of poop on them.
That's right, yeah. You know, my current philosophy is if I'm going to write this story about these characters, how can I make what is going to happen to them worse than death? Okay? So it's not just how can I make it worse, but worse than death. The second thing that I had to fix didn't come along until after I was starting to succeed as a writer. I was selling books and writing, on a fairly regular basis. But what I found was it's not just making time to write, it's making time to focus. And for me, I can sit down and write for a day and a half or for an hour and a half, but I'm just kind of getting into it by the time that I have to stop. And what I really prefer is to be able to have an entire day after day, dedicated to writing in a block of at least 10 days to 2 weeks so that I can really get into it. If I can do that, I'll write at a pace of about 25 or 30 pages a day. And I'll have time to do some brainstorming and whatnot in between.
How many hours a day?
When I'm doing that, I am writing full time. I may stop and take some time off.
Well, for what I say, is it 8 hours? Is it 10 hours? Or just what you can feel?
When I say focus, I mean I want all of my time on focus. I want to answer the phone. I should be answering emails. I'm 16 hours a day.
Well, that is one thing that they say to do. Is your neighbors who know your home, that kind of stuff. You're telling them that I'm at work. You don't answer the phone, I go to stuff. You are putting in the hours there rather than solving someone else's problem or whatever.
Exactly. And that's kind of tough because that means that, you've got to throw it all on your wife, for example. If you've got four or five kids and you say, honey, I love you. I'm going to go make some money. I'm going to go out to Mexico and I'm going to answer an email, my phone calls. Unless God calls, but I'm not talking to anybody, and so that's really tough for me to sort of just leave everybody else behind and say, okay, I'm going to do that.
Well, if that's why you do your best work, it's going to be better. Okay, another question. No questions? Okay, go ahead.
This one's a little bit more specific, but I know in a lot of novels, your characters have to travel from place one to place two. And how do you, if nothing's supposed to happen during the traveling period, how do you write that so it doesn't get, terribly boring, but you still pace the novel?
Well, there are several ways. Should we go here? Start in the middle here. Is Jane Patch, why don't you start in the middle? Go next, and then.
Well, I've never really had to write that. In my 13th reality books, they have what's called linking. They use quantum physics in my book, but that's like Discovery Channel level of quantum physics.
That's the best.
So they're really, I've never really dealt with long travel scenes, but I love to read fantasy books. So you always get this little feeling in your gut when you know that the hero is about to take a 1,000-mile journey. Like, what are the next few chapters going to be like? And so I like it when people are good at it, but I don't really know how to do it, so I'll pass on.
I actually like traveling. It's in the TV show House. Okay, you ever notice that whenever House is having just regular dialogue, he always walks from his office to the elevator, or those walk in a circle back to his office? It's because just they're in the act of doing something other than just talking. They're sitting in one place and talking.
To take out the talking head syndrome.
So
they're actually doing something,
a sense of completion.
And then can get your character moving along.
Yeah, you have a journey that you're fulfilling, and while you're doing the journey, plot still occurs, but that way you're not just static and dumping info on the reader.
But you can deepen your characters, make them deeper, more rounded out, and including jumping to your evil characters and doing the same thing.
Yeah, I like having trouble.
Okay, how about?
I guess I can say two things. First is, if it's boring to you, why is it there? Just cut it and just put
say
a break and
say
and then
say
2 days later, they're at whatever place, right?
They arrive.
So they arrive. Why have it there if it's boring to you? The other thing is, though, is if you want to have something happen while they're traveling, then something has to happen, right? There's got to be some other problem or some mystery or some conflict. Something else has got to be interesting during that time, unless, something's going on in the traveling that's interesting by itself. So my thing is, get rid of it. If you're bored with it, and it doesn't have to be there, get rid of it. Or you got to put something else there that is interesting.
and then they can travel more.
That's why I sleep on airplane flights.
Those are two methods of, first, find something interesting, character growth, conversations that they can have. I mean, that's always downtime where people can, sit down and reveal why it is that they are the way, why I'm such a twisted bum, syndrome. And of course the other way is to, as you said, just go ahead and cut to it, 2 days later, John, stumbled from, stumbled in the castle, such and such, with swollen feet and sinuses swollen from the allergies, from crossing through the woods. You could do something like that. But then the third way is, Michael Stackpole does this quite effectively, coming up with magical travel. Okay? We can't use this very often, but, there are these two travel points so that we can travel about 1,000 miles. We can get 894 miles out of it if we go to this travel zone and work this spell.
Ignore us.
And so he'll do a little chapter where, they have to go and unlock the magic that unleashes their spell, and boom, they're there. And that's kind of cool, too. So those are three ways to do it. And then, of course, you can have the tireless horses, that's what I do with wars. You can build some rooms of strength, of brawn and stamina, and, those things will run all day long, on the fumes.
Just like your car, gas them up.
Yeah.
There are a lot of stories where people will go on this thing, on a little episode during the travel. You'll go to a house, and some evil house or something, what I'm saying? Problems at the house, or the problem with the people, or but you have to have something there.
Yeah, you have to have meeting more of the party, or losing some of the party, or having some terror happen to
them. Change. It's always, let's say you've got one of the goals as a writer is your hero should meet the villain as much as possible in your books, okay? A lot of times we'll tend to want to have a character, there's no way he can beat the villain, so, they can't meet, okay? But if you've got a travel story, for example, you could take your villain's minions and have him meet the minions, along the way. So, all of a sudden we're fighting trolls halfway down this 200 miles into this 1,000-mile journey. So you could throw in incidents like that where it sort of foreshadows what's going to happen when we do actually meet the evil overlord and just how desperate and worthless this journey is, kind of thing.
Or like the Harry Potter, where each book he meets the evil overlord, but doesn't kill him.
Yes.
And almost gets killed himself, essentially. Mm-hmm. But still, you bring the evil guy in there.
Yeah. There needs to be that meaning. You can have something like Terminator,
Okay. Any other questions?
I guess I have a question. I don't know how exactly to phrase it, but I have characters my protagonist in general, who does things that most people don't like, and I've tried to explain through motivation or through different means to make her sympathetic so that we don't mind having her as a protagonist, but at the same time she does things that we really wouldn't respect in someone if they had done it in real life.
Do your other characters not respect her? Because they should not respect her?
No, they don't, obviously, okay. But we need to, as the reader, in order for the story to work.
So you have to change it some way or something?
I just want to know how to make her more sympathetic or not necessarily, I don't know, do you guys understand? Yeah, okay.
I understand. Yes. Why don't we start from that side, come this way, okay?
Sure. There are a lot of good examples of villainous heroes. People that are despicable that we still root for. And on the fluffy side, you have people like Aladdin, right? He's a thief, right? He steals things all the time. But we're like, oh, we love Aladdin. And then on the other side, you have people that are gangsters in very realistic movies like The Godfather or something like that. And you're rooting for them, but they're just terrible people. And so some of the things that you can do, just two things off the top of my head that you can do, is number one, if they're fighting against something that's worse than they are, mm-hmm. and we can root for or rooting against that thing, or you've got this terrible, despicable man, but he's going to save the baby, right? Do you see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
I'm going to still root for. The other thing is you can show a different side. No, he's Well, maybe some people are, but most people have a mixture of things, right? And they can do something that's something noble. I remember Last Samurai. The guy that's the main character, we start off, he's a drunk, right? And he's a loud mouth, and he's not anybody that you're going to really like. But he was very skilled at what he did with his military background. And I was so interested in that part that I was okay to go along with the ride on this thing because he was so interested. So those are just two ideas.
Tortured hero type thing.
Yeah. But he was still not somebody to respect and root for, you know, not until the end when he had changed. But they got me because the circumstances that he was in was interesting, and he had some great skills. So those are two ideas.
In my first novel series, the protagonist is actually a really likable person. In the second series that I'm finishing up right now, the protagonist is just a jerk. He's complete and utter scumbag. He's one time, the best description I heard in the book of him was a godless, self-absorbed narcissist. And I'll tell you this, people love this guy, all the advanced readers who have loved this person so far, because he thinks he's the good guy. In his head, he's the good guy. He's the hero. He's a complete jerk, but he's the hero. And there's a logical progression of why he is the way he is. And the book is really about this guy trying in his own screwed up way to do what is the right thing. So even though if you were to meet this person in real life, you would hate him, as you read the book, you're rooting for him. And it just worked out that way. So I think part of it is he a believable, or she is it a believable person? Do you understand where they're coming from, why they are the way they are? And even if you are writing a good character, a sympathetic character, humans, we're still going to have issues. But don't go too far the other way, because there's, I don't know, sometimes, like for example, Stephen King novels, for me, sometimes I'll be reading them, and the protagonist of the Stephen King novel is so despicable.
You write him dead.
Yeah, you just don't care if he lives or dies. In fact, you're rooting for where the monster is to come and eat this guy, so the book will be over. So don't go too far. But as long as you have a reason for being the way they are, and people can understand and relate to that reason.
In other words, you have to tell the reader what the reason is so that they won't despise the character. If there's some reasoning, however convoluted it is, if they understand the character, then they'll be able to, in some way, identify.
Just kind of see yourself in the same position.
Right.
If you have a degree in accounting, though, this just all makes sense.
So buy Larry's book.
Do you watch The Office?
Yeah.
The comedy show. Mm-hmm. Okay, it's one of my favorite shows. Michael, the boss, mm-hmm. is, there's nothing good about him. I mean, he's always embarrassing. I mean, I cringe when I watch it. He says he's politically incorrect, he's rude. But that show is so brilliant because when he gets his feelings hurt, or, you know, when his love interest just goes crappy, or by the show having bad things happen to him, even though we should be despising him, I think he's the character everyone loves the most because we feel empathy for him. So I don't even know if I know how they do it, but I just think it's a good example. Even though it's a comedy, you can apply the principles.
There's a couple of things you can do. One thing, give your heroine a genuine, decent, close friend. Okay? If we have somebody who admires us or likes us, or if you've got a character in a story that is admired or liked by other people, then the audience tends to say, well, that person's likable. Obviously, somebody else likes them, so you know, they're, you know, maybe I'm just being.
Does it have to be an honest friend? Does it have to be a friend who says, that was crappy what you did, or something like that?
Yeah, okay. Exactly. Yeah, they can recognize you have faults. Okay. The second thing you can do, your character can apologize. Okay, so she does something despicable, but then afterwards she feels bad about it, and at least bad enough to say, that was despicable of me. Okay? The third thing that you can do is give that character opportunities to grow. Okay? And by that I mean she can become a better person, and we believe that she is basically on that path. You know, if you watch the movie Jerry Maguire, okay, we have a character who starts out, he's a sports agent, and he's a pretty despicable person, and he has a sort of mental breakdown and says, hey, let's all be good guys to his bosses, and they say, you're fired. And they get rid of him, and so he has one client, and he's still an ass. And you know, at one point, he starts groping this, you know, nice single mother that was sort of taken with him, and, you know, he's a little bit drunk. And at that point, I just thought, okay, this movie's over. I mean, you know, this guy could fall into a meat grinder, and I don't care. And then all of a sudden, he turns around and he says, oh my God, I'm such an ass. I'm so sorry. Please forgive me. And he begs. And you go, yeah, wow, he's really sincere. Okay, I forgive him, you know, and we move on. So in every story that you write, there's one fellow, I think his name is Michael Hague, who's a writer in Hollywood. He says that in every story there's this inner war that should be going on, okay? And that war is between how you see yourself and how others see you, okay? And so, for example, if we have a romance story, and I've got somebody, and you know, James Dashner is my hero, and we're presenting him, you know, to this girl who says, "Oh, I think I'm falling in love with James Dashner." Then her father should say, "James Dashner is a creep. He's a dangerous man. If you look at him, he never smiles, and there's all sorts of things wrong with this guy. He's a lunatic. You stay away from him. You know, he's probably a serial rapist." And so there's the dad over here saying, you know, James Dashner's a bum, and then James Dashner, of course, is like,
I can see just that quote on a blur. Okay, I went to a convention and they said,
okay, the cover number, David Gaffner's not a serial rapist.
But the idea is that, you know, James Dashner, of course, now has to prove himself, you know, through his actions throughout the story, that he really is the hero that he envisions himself to be. He really is the kind of guy who, you know, is not a serial rapist, but is in fact the kind of guy who will, you know, pilot the airplane when it's about ready to go down and save all of the passengers on the 757. You know, that's the kind of guy he is, and so he becomes then worthy of the love of the heroine.
And even grows from being the jerk into the person.
Yes. In other words, the characters may even have to grow. Okay. But as long as she has that potential for growth, if she sees her own mistakes and she's really trying, we'll forgive her just about anything.
I want Dave to put a blurb on one of my books now.
Speaking of rapists. One of the most fascinating protagonists ever is Thomas Cullen,
yeah.
Who's read those.
Oh yeah.
He rapes a girl.
Yeah.
In the first book on page.
Page 20 or so.
Yeah, I mean it's not that far in the book, and you're like, this guy just raped a girl.
Yeah.
The series is called The Chronicles of Thomas Cullen. You know, and he's definitely the main dude.
He's a scumbag for most of that series.
But you know what? I mean, he's one of my favorite characters of all time. So I don't know how he did it, how Stephen thought of it, but he did it somehow. If you can overcome rape.
There is the solitary chapter because he does recognize,
yeah.
You know, after he's done it. At first he thinks that this is like some sort of weird dream or hallucination.
Yeah.
So he's just going to do what you do in dreams, which, I mean, I've never thought that way. I haven't been in the middle of a dream and said, I think I'll just go rape them, you know? But then once he starts realizing that, hey, this really was real, and, you know, and he starts becoming responsible, then we kind of like him.
Yeah, he does feel extreme remorse for that incident for the rest of the series.
Yeah, and he actually becomes the Christ figure at the end of that book, in the series. So.
Okay, now that was a great question.
This is one I'm always intensely curious about. How rigorous are each of you about outlining, when you approach a new novel, or a new series of novels, how rigorous are you about outlining?
Okay, let's go through this a little bit. How do you set up for a novel? Are you a person who just writes bare words, not editing for so long, then goes back and edit them? Are you ones that meticulously outline them and then write the novel? Are you ones, if you do outline, you stay with your outline, or it's just something like that? What's your creative process? If you have a beginning and an end and have to figure out the middle, or if you have it all plotted out in your brain, how you're going to do it, why don't you go through and just start with Dave here and then just go down through it.
Actually, I've tried it a bunch of different ways. I've pre-written, where I had no idea what I was going to write, and I outlined everything, every single chapter. And I kind of have come to the conclusion that I think about my novels so much that I like to outline them one third at a time, okay? My first outline is going to be the opening up through the inciting incident and into the first try-fail cycle, typically, and then, which, you know, is 150 pages or so. But I meticulously outline that. You know, I may have 30 pages of outline for that 150 pages. At that point, I stop because I really thought about what's going to happen in the middle, and I go through and outline that again, and then I write it. And then I usually do the same with the ending. The ending usually comes quickest because I've already been thinking about it now for two-thirds of the novel.
Okay. Wow. I said right when you were starting the question, I said, I bet we're all different. But every author I know is different. I really like to know the general... I usually come up with a premise that, okay, this would be a cool idea for a story. And then I just, for a couple of days, I just think about it. And I don't do any kind of meticulous outline, but what I do is maybe one or two pages of bullet points. Okay, this is going to happen, and this is going to happen, and this is going to happen. Very basic.
So as about as low as outline as you can get, just rough points, but not how soon it's going to happen or anything like that.
Yeah, but I really, really try to know how it ends.
So you kind of premise and the end?
Like, I want to know what, you know, what's the big twist at the end, and what's the big climax, and how is this going to end? And I don't stay sacred to that. I change things all the time, but I do like to have a general path, but most of it's in my head.
Okay. Actually, pretty similar to James. I do a rough outline. I know kind of where I want to end up.
Do you write it actually on paper?
Yes.
Okay.
But then again, it's only usually like 3 pages or, you know, a 300-page novel.
Right.
And that's how I've done it every time, except for one where I did more than just free rope, but I'm kind of stuck halfway through that one. So for me, I'm definitely an outline kind of guy.
Okay, go ahead.
I have to know where I'm going for the next little bit. I have to see the next little bit down the path, otherwise I cannot write the scene.
You mean in your head or on paper?
Well, I have to know, and for me, I have to put it down on paper. So before I ever write any scene or chapter, I say, this is what's supposed to happen, and then I get a couple of bullets out, and I can say, okay, this is, and then I can go into draft mode and write those scenes. If I don't have that, sometimes I'll do some writing, you know, just say, where is this going to take me? And I just go and I do free writing. But that's to help me really get some ideas. Then I usually, what will happen is I'll take that, and I'll say, okay, now, how do I really want to do this, or what has to happen?
And use parts of that for your outline.
So usually what happens is I spend a lot of time in the beginning thinking about things, and I'll have a document, and I'm, you know, characters and all that kind of stuff.
Can you see the accountant coming out, Matt? Really? That's all it is. Like,
well, I'm an analytical thinker. I usually have to see the big picture before I can do the trees. And so that's just how I learn and how I approach things. So I got to get kind of a big picture. And so what will happen then is at the end of that process, however long that takes, whether it's a short story or novel, I will create some type of outline. And it's not probably as meticulous as Dave's, but I'll still have a step sheet of, okay, they need to do this, and then they'll take this action. And what happens is it peters out. I can't do usually more than a third of the book either. Well, I don't know if Dave can do more, but I get to that part, and then I just kind of, it gets really vague. So what will happen then is I write up to that point. It's changing all the time. All the time it changes. I get to that point, okay, now the next little piece. Let me get out just a little bit out in front, because now I can focus on the scene stuff, and I write to that next piece, and then it's like, and that's just how I do it the whole way through the book.
And the book tends to write itself, but in thirds, is what you're saying.
Well, yeah, but this is general. It's very general out here.
Right.
Like my third novel that I've got coming, right? When I wrote the outline for it, basically it was, the villain comes back, it's really bad, and that's the end. Right? And so that's about how general it was. I just knew my villain was coming back.
Frankly, yeah, mine will be like, okay, the hero's going to win.
Yeah, and as you get closer to it,
things
get.
Now, do you have to have the end of your book in your mind before you start, or just the general what's going to happen?
Well, so the one I'm writing now, I had this great. They were going to go out. They were going to get these things called. Anyway, they were going to go on a quest and get these things and bring them back. Well, partway through the beginning of the book, that all fell by the wayside. So I had this ending. That's gone.
Okay.
This whole other ending that came out, well, and now I've got a different ending.
Well,
that
books,
to.
Books will do that. They'll yeah. go the way they go. But yeah. still, I just want.
I have a general idea.
But you have a general idea, and what, yeah. If it ever gets in there or not.
That's
it,
another
depends,
question.
Right?
Yeah.
Well, and it's important to know that many authors do the pre-writing. I mean, Stephen King's the biggest example. He never outlines. He never plots. Now Stephen King's one of my idols. I think he's a brilliant writer. However, I never really liked how his books end. Yeah, it's weird that I can love an author that much and always just kind of accept that, well, his ending's going to suck. But, I think it's because he does, you know, the whole thing of you paint yourself in a corner and he just kind of comes up with an ending. It's almost like he's just accepted, all my readers won't care. He just accepts
it. It almost seems like he gets 800 pages in and gets tired.
On this same line, I've got a question. On this same line, there's character-driven books, there's world-driven books, all of that stuff. How much of your books are world-building? How much of them are character-building? And how much do you think they should be? I mean, character-building on all the things versus world-building. Because you'll have some books that are entirely world. You'll have some books that are entirely character. Why don't we start with you and come this way?
Well, I know I like delightful characters. I like the plot. I castigate myself. If it doesn't grab me in that first page when I'm in the store, I will never go past it. I have a friend, he will read 60 pages of a book and be bored, waiting for that book to get going. So I know something has got to happen. Either I've got to have some wacky or interesting character or some plot thing going on for me to like it. So for my books, that's what I try to do.
Now,
so
character-driven or plot-driven?
Well, it doesn't matter. I like both.
You like
so it doesn't matter. Usually it's plot. But so for I think every person is probably different. And you got to figure out what it is that you like. Because I don't think there's a gold standard.
Right.
So for me, though, I know what I like. And so I know I love delightful characters. I love, I love an interesting plot. And I like world details. So I don't know. I'm not giving a good answer to this. I like it all.
That's actually a good answer. How about yourself? What do you think you are?
I agree with John, though I tend to probably be more character-driven than world-building. Though if you have a stupid world, you can have interesting characters and the book sucks.
Right.
I mean, you really got to have all four tires on the car.
But although you kind of need all three, usually it is, you can count a book as one, the other, or the other, almost all the time. There's very few that it's a balance of all three. And usually an author has a weakness in one of those sides. Now just...
I've got a good character for myself.
Okay. How about you, Dean?
I think my books are definitely plot-driven. And then I try to make sure that within that plot that I've come up with, I always think about plot first, a cool storyline, cool plot twist. And then I'm like, okay, I got to make sure that the characters are awesome. Then I try to do the characters. World building is probably my weakness.
Okay.
For me, I almost always do my world building first, and then I create my characters as I'm thinking about my plot. Mm-hmm. And there's another leg on this, which really deals with. I'll explain this. I often talk about them as plotting devices, but there's really ideas for generating and creating interesting story arcs and things like that. And it goes closer to stylistic elements and stuff on this. Those become very important for me. I would almost say that it's, like you say, there's all four tires you gotta have. You know, but I can't write, I don't think, truly terrible characters. I will take my characters and I have to discover the voices of the characters and find out how they really think and how they're acting. And I've thrown away, the first 100 pages of the novel as many as 7 or 8 times until I felt that I got my characters right. And then I'm able to proceed. So I can't just have a good plot and wooden characters. It has to all work together.
One just a little backup question on this. Have you ever been writing and had a character steal the book and either had to throw him away or rewrite the
character, that kind of thing?
Yeah. Had to kill the character off or else he was going to take the book away?
Yeah, absolutely.
How about you? Do you have it? Never had a character.
That I had to kill because he was going to steal my book? Not a character?
Yeah, but you ever the way I put it for Jango 1 is he's got Strider. Here you got Frodo as the is the main character. You get up there, Strider is too dynamic of a character to not be the lead in a book. It should have been a different book with Strider. Do you see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And all I'm saying is like that. Strider kind of stole the story from the Hobbits after he and after they got together. He stole the story. He was the Navy SEAL in the whole thing.
And recognizing that, turned Gandalf then into the next Strider. He said, okay, so Gandalf's going to steal the show from Strider. Then Gandalf has to get killed.
Right.
Okay. And then Strider has to go off and go on a completely different quest
else, right.
So that we can put the focus
back on the
if you read my latest book, The Whirling Horde, I have a character who starts out who starts getting strong way too fast. I had to kill him 100 pages later. If I didn't, my editor would have. So my editor would have.
There are so many people. Sometimes you develop these. I know in my writing, I have a tendency to. I will get interested in all sorts of people in my book. And if I'm not careful, all of a sudden I have 20 storylines, and there's no, you know, you can't do that in a 100,000 words. You just can't do it. So that happens, but you just have to focus.
You just kill them out right away.
I just say you're able to throw them away
so they don't take over the book.
But hopefully all of them do that. You know, hopefully all of them are so interesting to you that you're enjoying reading about it.
Of course. I'm talking about is once in a while you'll see books where they should have killed this character that they bring up halfway in the book.
Because he takes
over the leading place in the book.
It happens all the time, just about every author. I mean,
the Robert Jordan Wheel of Time is written, and it's got, 500 some odd characters now?
Yeah, exactly.
And he's never ended the first book.
But I've got to say, in his defense, I was with Tom Doherty, at dinner one time years ago when Wheel of Time was going to be a trilogy. And he was on the phone with Robert Jordan saying, no, it's not going to be a trilogy. I want 5 books. You know, I will pay you this extra money. And then about 2 years later, I was with him when he was calling Robert Jordan again and saying it's going to be 7 books,
really?
and so
it's not all Robert Jordan's fault.
So as an author, Robert Jordan was put in the position where he said, okay, I have this much story and I have these characters and I know what's going to happen to them. The only way to expand your series at that point is to bring in more interesting characters, and that's what he did.
So I always thought it was his fault. I didn't know the editor.
No, absolutely. I mean, Tom did that with me when I wrote The Golden Queen as a standalone novel. And, I sent it in to him on a Monday. On Tuesday, I got a phone call from him saying, I want the next 2 books in that trilogy. And I said, well, it's not a trilogy, it's standalone. And he says, no, Dave, it's a trilogy. And I've got, X thousands of dollars to prove it.
It's a trilogy.
Okay,
yeah,
thank
you,
man.
I like your thinking.
Next question. Yes.
Have you ever had a character that just you really liked? The main character, whatever, I don't care which one, but one that you really just enjoy writing, or whatever scenes they're in just flow. Could you give an example of those?
Yeah. Let's go with you first.
I mean, seriously, in Brotherhood of the Wolf, I had a character, Roland Borenson, that I really liked. And my editor killed him at the end of the book. I got done. He says, that character's taken over the series, and he's going to have too many characters. So you just have to kill him right here at this castle wall scene. And I'm like, oh, I don't want to do that. And I've gotten fan mail from people saying, you are a terrible person because you killed Roland Borenson. I love your characters. And
Wait,
I just have to say, it wasn't me. It's my editor.
So
James,
I have always thought it's so cheesy when authors talk about how real their characters become and all that. But man, it is so true. Sometimes I'll hear some song or some piece of music that will make me think of my characters, and I'll get all weepy at it. Or I'll imagine some music will make me think of this certain scene,
and they'll just, they seriously do become real to you. But yeah, I don't know, I mean, all of them basically I fall in love with.
I love my characters, and they do become people to you. And yeah, they do have theme songs after a while. Seriously, I have on my iTunes, I have a playlist, and I actually have character theme songs. It's cheesy to say, but
that's a good idea, though. It actually motivates you to write. One of the things I found is that when you have theme music for a character and you put that on, it's easy to just get into that character's head.
It sets the mood immediately. So when you sit down for your 4-hour session or whatever, you just get going. And the characters, as an author, they do become real to you. One of the criticisms I got on my first book reviews were, you didn't kill enough of your characters. I think you liked them too much. Well, it's the first book of a trilogy. I can't just kill everyone. But yeah, they do become real to you.
So the two secrets here are listen to theme songs for your characters and become an accountant.
That's it.
We don't audit for yet.
Seriously, the iPod and the whole playlist concept has helped my writing career tremendously.
How do you guys listen to... I listen to songs, and then I start singing along, and I can't focus. How do you guys do that?
No, I have to listen. I have to listen to primarily to soundtracks.
Soundtracks.
Yeah.
Soundtracks.
James Horner. Any movie by Michael Bay.
Get soundtracks. You'll be surprised.
That's interesting. Right. Yeah, we'll try soundtracks.
Get the soundtracks. Soundtracks.
Yeah. I'll get hooked on this drug.
So yeah, and it helps your writing. Why not?
Huh? Yeah. I'll go right there right now. Soundtrack.
Thank you. Thank you, Amit. We're out of time.
Hello. Hello.